In the many years that we took pilgrimage groups to India, the travel was multifaceted because many of the people that we took on that trip had never been to what you would call the developing world, never been out of a westernized country, and never been to a place where there was such an all-pervasive lack of material goods. And in another very unusual way that you just can't even imagine if you've only lived in America, that kind of all-pervasive poverty and the lack of the opportunity for mass education and comfort and material goods like we have here draws large numbers of souls who have a very different kind of karma. You just don't see en masse in America the kind of karmic groups that you see in India, probably also in Africa and China, but I've never been to those countries. So one is confronted with sights that can be very disconcerting, especially over the 25 years that we did those trips. India actually, it's really been the most significant changing decades in Indian history, but especially at the beginning, most dramatically expressed by our stay in the Oberoi Hotel in Calcutta, the newly remodeled, gloriously comfortable marble bathroom Oberoi Hotel in Calcutta. And you would be able to, during the 4 or 5 or 6 days that we'd stay there, stand in your beautifully appointed room and look on the sidewalk and watch the life of 3 or 4 families that was taking place on the sidewalk at the bottom from wherever you were. And for many people going to India, their great anxiety was to be confronted with what they naturally imagined would be this kind of poverty and the consequent sense of suffering and the kind of helplessness you would feel in the face of that. And one of the roles that I played on that trip was just talking and counseling, the same thing that I do. And we began to sort of know the rhythm of having to help people through this disconcerting experience. You all have heard me, many of you have heard me talk about this. And over time, I had to reflect a great deal on suffering, because from our perception, when you go into that culture, you see a lot of what you would call suffering. And much of it is not a matter of semantics. It's just human beings trying to find their next meal. It's vividly exemplified to me by this picture I still have in my mind of this very elderly, slightly crippled woman sitting on the side of the road with a little tiny handkerchief laid out, and she'd taken one bulb of garlic and had broken it into cloves and was selling the cloves one by one, because that's sometimes all that people could buy would be buy. They'd buy one clove of garlic for that night's rice. And then she would take whatever tiny bit of money she would make and she would use that to buy her rice and so on. Now, everything that happens in this world is under the auspices of God. There's no place we go, even though we can imagine that this is, there's even a phrase in English, God forsaken. You go someplace and you say, oh, what a God forsaken place this is. Because somehow or another, it's so far away from our human idea of how things ought to be that we imagine even God himself has turned his back on it. But of course, once we begin to understand anything of the principles of self-realization, we realize that that's an impossibility, because it's not just a question of omnipotent power or something like that. There's only one reality in all of creation, and that is the infinite consciousness. God manifested this world. He became this world, Sat Chit Ananda, ever existing, ever conscious, ever new bliss is the underlying definition of creation itself. But golly, it sure doesn't look like that a lot of the time. And in our Festival of Light, when we talk about the bird whose progress through these stages of understanding is symbolic of our own, that this bird is manifested by God and sent out with a noble mission, that he is to take the gifts that God has given him, the gifts of life, of creativity, to be as God is, and to share who he is, and what, to take those talents and multiply them, and then pass them out as freely to others as God has given them to us. But the bird gets egoically identified with the pleasure of what he's doing, and he rebels against that. And then he goes into the time of suffering, in which it never quite works out for him, but he never quite gets it. Now, in this story of Christ, what you have, of course, is an avatar. You have a supremely free being who has no karmic lessons of his own. For us, when we encounter circumstances that are contrary, seem contrary to our desires, we can be certain that we are engaged in some kind of a necessary karmic balance that has been sent to us, like the little bird, like the storm clouds the little bird had to go through, to help show us how to be in order to navigate the storms and the rains and all of the elements. But in the life of Christ, he had nothing to learn. He had conquered long since. He had transcended every limiting condition. He was Satchitananda, nothing else. He put it in simple, symbolic words. I and my Father are one, he said. The Father is the power beyond creation. He was one with that. Again and again he would speak, if you have seen me, you have seen the Father. I go back to the Father from where I came. You know, who is this Father? They would say, it is I. Jesus would say, I and my Father are one. As clearly as he could express it in those times, he declared his perfect freedom. And yet, his life had a purpose, and his life was to show us how a life can be perfectly lived. Now, it was a very gross age in which he lived, and so the challenges that he suffered could not be subtle. You know, a little mental anguish here and there would not be enough to get the point across. So Jesus had to go through this experience, and this experience was the confronting, well, there's only really one word for it, the confronting of evil. Because there's a reality about life which in our naivete we like to deny. And it's very popular these days to just sort of pretend that everything is really lovely. And, you know, when the 9/11 attack happened in New York City, and, you know, a kind of calculated evil that was just almost impossible for the average person to get his mind around, that these people would have dedicated themselves with such, you know, determination and then committed suicide to take all of this down with them. It's very hard to imagine. And there was an interesting response from some people. If there was any sort of tone of outrage, there would be this, oh, well, we have to just love and understand these people. And Swami Kriyananda spoke very strongly in another way. He said, in another context, he used an example. He said, if a rabid dog enters a village, you have to shoot it, because otherwise it will wreak havoc and destruction everywhere. Now, you know, no one wants to hear harsh words like that, but what Swami was saying also in that context was, there are those who delight in the sufferings of others, who delight in inflicting suffering on others, and there is no other definition of evil but that. And even though we don't want to know that, sooner or later, in our progress towards self-realization, we have to be able to look truth right in the face and not flinch. And we can't do it just by clouding over our consciousness and pretending it's not happening. You look out the window of that hotel and these people are very, very poor. And we also have to be able to say in our own mind, they're not God forsaken. God is with them as much outside on the sidewalk as he is in here in this beautiful room. Because God is walking with each one of us, I dare say leading each one of us, to exactly the place we need to be for the expansion of our consciousness. And almost everyone has to be motivated by suffering. And it would be really wonderful if that weren't true. But that's not the world in which we live. And that's not the consciousness, really, of any one of us. We don't seek suffering, but we have to see the consequences of our own behavior. And we have to understand, then be motivated enough to shift. Isn't that what the process of all of our lives is? In some way or another, we feel we are less than perfect in our experience of Satchitananda. And that slight uneasiness or massive despair, whatever level it is that hits us, just moves us to put out the energy to shift, to restrain our words, to be kinder in our responses, to be more broad in our understanding, to be more patient in the way we deal with things, to be more courageous or attuned, whatever the words might be, more disciplined, more free, whatever it might be. So here we have in the life of Jesus this little segment of his life, his arrest, his crucifixion, before we get to the complete transcendence of all of this. And even though it's not really about the suffering, what it's about is about the courage in the face of suffering. And so we have him walk through this extraordinary story, which begins with gathering his disciples for the Last Supper and the long and poignant tale of warning that he offers them, which they only dimly understand is that he keeps telling them that he's going away to a place that they can't go with him. And then they say, where could you be going and why can't we go with you? And in that scene, Peter also protests, Lord, I'll go with you anywhere. And he declares with such force, Lord, I'll die for you. And then Jesus looks at him and says, will you? Just like that. And then he says, oh, Peter, before the morning comes, before the rooster crows at the dawn, three times this night you will say that you never even knew me. And that's what is played out through what David was reading. Three times someone says, after Jesus has been arrested, after he's been taken, now that he's being interrogated by these high priests and has begun to be mistreated, and this totally unexpected change has suddenly entered their lives. Just hours before, they were gathered together having this wonderful experience with Jesus as he instructed them. Just days before they were entering triumphantly into Jerusalem, now he's been arrested, he's been seized, and Peter had tried to fight for him. Peter, who carried a sword, was going to defend Jesus against being arrested, and he hacked at the servant's ear and cut it off, and Jesus stopped him. Jesus wouldn't even let Peter defend him. So now Peter is there, and the place where Jesus is being held. Three times, strangers say to him, don't I know you? Haven't I seen you walking with him? No, 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 Peter says. Three times. And then after the third time, he hears the sound of the rooster, and his mind has just been blinded until this, and when he hears the sound of the rooster, he remembers what happened. And then they say, he goes weeping from that place. Imagine. You know, now he makes it up later, but nonetheless, like life, isn't it? We make it up later, but in the moment. So Jesus is arrested, and he won't allow himself to be defended, because why would you defend me? Later he says to Pontius Pilate, when Pontius says, are you a king? Are you the king in this way? He said, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my disciples would have defended me. Because if we're going to fight might with might, that's what they would have done. But my kingdom is not of this world. So Jesus is giving us, you know, the beginning of one of his lessons. Where is our consciousness? Where do we live? Where does our power come from? Even as he's going to be arrested, does he shrink from it? No, he hears the army coming and he walks out boldly. This is my destiny. For this hour was I born. I could pray, Lord, Lord, save me from this hour, he says. But for this hour was I born. You see, we have another example. Things come to us and we cringe in fear. Oh, I don't want to have to do this. Please take it away from me. This is too hard. You know, this is too painful. Let me see if I can find an easier way. Or we just kind of dull our consciousness so we don't really have to deal with it. We hide until the test shrinks. But Jesus shows us, with no need of his own, ah, the test is coming to me. I was born to face this. And he asks them. He doesn't even wait to be found. He asks them, who are you looking for? Are you looking for me? Imagine, you know, when we see our karma coming, what do we do? Do we run to the front door and open it like this? I remember one of my friends once told me, they were in a house at Ananda Village, and some really crazy person somehow found their way and just burst into the house where Swamiji was. And my woman friend, who's not particularly big, dashed out in front of Swami to defend him against this intruder. Swami laughed, you know, as if she was big enough to do so. But then he also was very touched. And she was too, in a sense, by just how, without any consideration for self, she stepped forward into whatever was coming. You see, that's the spirit that we have to face. Not, oh, please, please, don't criticize me. But instead, all right, Lord, let me bring whatever I am into this light. And then Jesus is there being interrogated by Pontius Pilate. And, you know, Pilate is becoming more and more concerned about this. He's also, it's not in this story, but it's in others of the stories. Pontius Pilate's wife has had a dream about Jesus. And she knows that he's a holy man. Many of the traditions say that she then became a devoted follower after Jesus died. She sends a message to Pontius Pilate. Have nothing to do with the condemnation of this man. So Pilate is somehow, both because of the warning of his wife and some awareness on his own part, that this is not an ordinary criminal. He's seen many ordinary criminals come before him, and this is not an ordinary criminal. And Pilate wants to somehow get out of this, because he can see that this is not righteous, what they're trying to do. And he tries every way he can, and he wants Jesus to help him. And finally, in exasperation at the end, he says to Jesus, don't you know I have the power to free you or to crucify you? Now, every person Pilate has ever said this to has responded in a predictable manner. What can I do to be freed? In one way or another, even at least reacts to that possibility. Jesus' response again, perfectly instructive. You have no power over me except the power that was given to you by my heavenly Father. Even now, legions of angels could rescue me. But it's not to be so, because he knows that God has put him exactly where he wants to be, where God wants him to be. You know? And in our Festival of Light, we talk about the little bird struggling against the wind, struggling against the darkness, struggling against the confusion of not knowing where he is and what's going to happen. And the night whispers, surrender to me. Now, what you have to understand is that Jesus' courage in this, that Jesus' acceptance was not weakness, nor was it even slightly passive. In fact, he stood as he stood and faced both the crowd and Pontius Pilate without the slightest flinching, because his power was not of this world. You know, there is a force in this world that tries to put out the light. It has to be faced. Sooner or later in our lives, we recognize that it's not enough just to be nice all the time. It's just not going to happen like that. That sooner or later we confront forces that are really trying to put out the light. And we have to stand in the power of that light. And all of the energy that we might use to run around in mad circles trying to make the world different than it is, instead we use all that power drawn to a focus within us to stand in the light. Stand in the power of God that is always with us. There's a remarkable story from a completely other context of the man named Tom Brown, who was an Indian tracker. Not an Indian himself, an American, Native American Indian I'm talking. He found himself in a position, without telling the whole story, of being pursued by a pack of wild dogs, and they had cornered him, and they were coming for him, and he had no way of escaping. And instead of running or crying, he sat and he did what he'd been trained to do, which we would call, he went into the Om. He went into the spirit of creation that he had learned to revere. He went into the Om. And he just went into the Om vibration like that. And a long time later, he came out of that, and the dogs were nowhere to be seen. And from their tracks, he could see that they had raced right toward where he was, and then they lost the scent, even though they were surrounding him at that point. And then they milled about, as he saw from the tracks, in total confusion, and finally wandered off. My kingdom is not of this world. Master tells this story, and the Dr. Lewis tells the story of being out in a boat when a sudden storm came up and it looked like the boat would go down. And Master, Dr. Lewis again, went into the Om. It's just like, nothing else will save me, so I will just go out of this world. And he went into the Om vibration. And then they weathered the storm. And at the same time in California, on the opposite coast, Master suddenly became very agitated and said, Dr. Lewis is in trouble, big trouble. He said like this. But then they weathered the storm, and when they came in, as soon as Dr. Lewis walked into the house, the phone rang, and it was Master. And he said, well, doctor, came very close to getting wet, didn't you? Just like that. But my kingdom is not of this world. That statement of Jesus, you see, is true for all of us. He says to his disciples, you have to understand, he says, after I am gone, the world will hate you as it hated me. They hate you because I've taken you out of the world. I've lifted you from their world, and then those forces that want to pull down the light will try to pull you down. But then he says so sweetly, but be of good cheer, I have conquered the world. So we listen to this extraordinarily dramatic story of how Jesus faced, calmly accepted, and in the end, by that courage, completely overcame everything. And his destiny is our destiny. To be crucified in such an overt and dramatic and Kali Yuga manner, well, it would be insincere to say, we hope not. To be asked to transcend all limitation in the awareness of God, absolutely, certainly, inevitably. And will we hide, you know, in the bushes, hoping it'll pass us by? Or when we hear those divine opportunities, will we come forward and say to our karma, are you looking for me? Can I help you? Can you help me to become not of this world? That's all that Jesus is showing us. And the more we see it as acts of infinite courage, and the less we see it as, oh, frightening and suffering, then the more we are able to receive. What enables us to receive the power of Jesus that will make us like him is to be on his wavelength, to see his world as he saw it. When he said, I am going where you can't go, but I can lead you there. I mean, where you don't know where I'm going, but I can lead you there. Where is the way, they said. That's when Jesus said, I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. I am the light. And it's wide open to us if we can put ourselves into his consciousness, then his spirit will take us.